This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 153 was recorded on February 7th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. Hante Investments founder and CIO Alex Gurevich returns as this week's feature interview guest. Alex and I will discuss everything from the business cycle to bond yields to global risks posed by China's debt overhang to the future of the European Union. We'll have an abbreviated post-game segment due to travel schedules this week.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's start off with the S&P 500. What's going on?
Well, Patrick, as I've said in the last several weeks, I think that we've seen the first big wave down in a new bear market, and that what we're in now is a bear market rally, a correction to the upside. Question is it over yet, or does it have farther to go to the upside before it's time to short this market? Now, it's difficult when you're dealing with views in different time frames. I'm definitely bearish in the long term. I think the top is in. I think we're in a new bear market, and that means at any point some bad news could really tip the scale and all of a sudden, you know, major sell-off is upon us again. We don't really have that big news event or catalyst to the downside. Well, Patrick, all things considered, with corporate buybacks back on the radar screen and everything else, I'm guessing that we're not done yet and that maybe there is more upside in this market before we eventually top out, roll over, and head back down. Was today's abrupt sell-off on Thursday morning the beginning of the end? It could be. I kind of doubt it, but anything's possible. We'll see what happens.
Eric, let's move on to that U.S. dollar index. Is this thing going to break out?
Well, Patrick, as I've been saying for I've forgotten how long now, I am definitely bullish the U.S. dollar. Now, what I said last week is, boy, with the Fed pivoting to this very dovish stance, you know, maybe that's going to result in a pullback that would last for several weeks before eventually my outlook for resolving to a higher dollar would be fulfilled. Well, geez, it's only a week later, and despite the dovish pivot from the Fed, already we've moved to a new, at least on an intraday basis, a new higher high. So we've put in a higher low on an intraday basis, a higher high in this dollar chart. Everything is looking, and we've moved well above the level that we were at when the Fed made that dovish pivot announcement. So this incredibly dovish news has suddenly come back out of the market, at least is reflected in the dollar index in just a week. How is that possible? Charlie McElligott had a couple of notes in his morning letter today. He thinks that as everyone else has pivoted dovish, it's basically the race to the bottom game, and the U.S. still looks like the cleanest dirty shirt in a very dirty laundry pile. So that perhaps is explaining some of the strength. I think, though, that there's no way to interpret this, but is unexpectedly, you know, better than I thought, and I've been very bullish on the U.S. dollar. The big test, though, we need to get to a close above 97, 97.50 maybe, in order to really show me that we're moving to the next level in this dollar bull market. But I think the dollar rally is about to resume, and the next test is going to be 97 and then 97.5.
Now, Eric, let's move on to crude oil. What's your thinking here?
Well, Patrick, as I've said for several weeks now, I think we've already topped out in a consolidation range between 45 and 55. I think the next move is a slow grind back down to 45. And then it's going to be a question of whether we can go lower, say, below 40. It would take some bearish economic news and inventory data to get us there. The market kind of dumped with equities and everything else this morning. We got down to about 51.80 this morning before bouncing back, and we're looking at about 52.70 as we're recording just after the pit close at 2:30 on Thursday afternoon. So, you know, as we get down to that level that we tested this morning, 50, high 51s, between 50.50 and 52, there's a fair amount of resistance levels in there. So I think it'll take several days to grind through it. But barring any unforeseen geopolitical news, I think the ultimate resolution is likely to be lower, down to 45 or so. After that, we'll see. I'll let you know when we get to that point.
Eric, what's your thinking here on gold? What's the next move?
Well, Patrick, today is a perfect example of an up-up day where gold and the dollar index both moved up on the same day. And that's exactly the pairs trade that we discussed in your market huddle with Kevin Muir. So I think that something has definitely changed here. My view, the reason that I had been bearish about gold is I really thought that despite what the naysayers were saying about the dollar, I thought the dollar was going to move higher. That led me to be bearish gold. Well, I got the dollar call right. The dollar is moving higher, but gold is moving higher at the same time. Now, that outcome of the dollar and gold moving into positive correlation where they both move up together is something we've been predicting on this podcast for more than 2 years now, but it hasn't really started to happen in earnest, and now we're seeing some pretty strong signs that it is happening. So I'm going to be looking for a dip here. I think we probably do have maybe a little bit further to dip before this is over, but it's starting to feel to me like that pairs trade, long gold and long the dollar at the same time, is making an awful lot of sense.
Eric, what's your thinking here on the 10-year treasury yield?
Well, Patrick, we're slowly trending lower down to 2.66 on the 10-year. But, you know, Alex Gurevich is the man for treasury yields. So I'm going to leave most of the commentary on fixed income for Alex's interview.
This week's featured interview guest is Alex Gurevich from Honte. Eric, why did we choose to bring Alex back to the show this week?
Well, it's been too long. Alex is a really smart guy, excellent macro thinker, and I think it's been more than a year now since we've had him on the program. I was actually speaking to Juliet DeClercq at Macro Voices Live, and Alex's name came up, and it caused me to remind you to get him back onto the program. So I'm really looking forward to getting his perspective on so many of the themes that we've been talking about, whether or not the business cycle is over and so forth. So why don't we go ahead and dive in and listen to Alex?
Great. So Eric's interview with Alex Gurevich is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Alex Gurevich, founder and chief investment officer at Honte Investments in San Francisco. I am so excited, Alex, to have you back on the program. It has been so long. You are an interest rates guy from way back. And boy, you know, interest rates, treasury yields in particular, have everybody's head spinning. Before we go into rates, though, why don't we start with the bigger picture of the business cycle? Is it finally over? You know, for so long, a lot of skeptics were saying, you know, it's overdue for this business cycle to be ending, credit cycle to be ending, but we kept getting proven wrong, and it had a little bit more left to it. Is it finally done?
Well, first, I'm glad to be back as well. And secondly, yes, it is done, unequivocally. I called for the end of the business cycle actually exactly a year ago. I pinned my tweet that we're transitioning into the late cycle dynamics, and I feel last 12 months we're following step by step exactly the playbook of the ending of the last two cycles. And I think where people have disagreements and feel certain things as being the signs of economic strength, those exact things actually historically indicated the end of the cycle.
Now, there was something that we heard from another guest on this program, which he said, fear the steepener. That was Charlie McElligott saying everybody worries about the yield curve flattening. It's actually when you get to a steepening just before everything falls apart that you have to worry. Are you echoing that same view, or do you mean something else when you say the opposite of what people were expecting?
I am not actually using a yield curve as an indicator of anything. I've written about this for a while. I feel like shape of the yield curve is only as much of an indicator of economy as, for example, if you're falling off a tall building and you're flying by the 10th floor, that's a good indicator that you're going to hit the ground, but it actually doesn't carry any new information. So I feel yield curve is based on information that is already available and actually does not say anything new to us. It's more of a product of the inputs. However, in terms of playing the yield curve as it should be, it is indeed true. The curve tends to be really flat when we go to late cycle. It actually stabilizes in the late cycle. It happens before each of the recent few recessions and refuses to invert too deeply, just as everyone is calling for inversion. And then when the Fed actually starts cutting rates, a very rapid steepening and somewhat sometimes defying logic, defying steepening starts to occur. Like, for example, when Fed starts cutting rates at the beginning of recession, usually long bonds don't benefit from those rate cuts at all, and all the benefit goes to 2-year notes.
So we're talking about a bull steepener where it's not about the 10-year yield blowing out, it's about the 2-year yield collapsing. And I shouldn't say collapsing, but rather being forced down by policy action, which is trying to be more accommodative to the economy. Does that lead you to a trading strategy? I know you said the information is already there, but sometimes you can play it. Do you look at something like a 2-10 steepener in this environment as a trade that you consider, or is there a better way to trade the market as you understand it?
I tend to not enter long short trades, so I typically actually don't do curve trades at all. Instead, I decide which part of the curve I want to be long. And for years, I've been focused on being long classical bond futures, and now I'm being distributing to the earlier part of the curve. The classical bond futures, the long end of the curve would prevail if I'm wrong and Fed stays on hold for a while or even hikes again, which seems increasingly unlikely, but many smart people still see it as a possibility. So assuming my view of the world is wrong and Fed stays hawkish, long bonds would benefit tremendously, while the short end actually could sell off from here. However, my central scenario is that Fed is starting to cut rates somewhere in the middle of this year, probably June to September 2019. And for this purpose, I like being long the very front end of the curve, which will most benefit from this.
And with respect to what's going on in general with interest rates, so many people were persuaded of what I've come to call the Jeff Gundlach view, the notion that, hey, you know, we've reached the end of a 35-year cycle. It's time to move back up in interest rates. And everybody was so convinced if we broke 3.10 or so on the 10-year yield that, you know, we'd never turn back. Well, needless to say, we turned back, and we turned back in a pretty big way. So how do you see the overall development of the Treasury yield space over the next year or two? What's driving this, and what should we expect next?
Well, first, I was really puzzled by people. Well, puzzled probably not the right word, because that happens at the end of every business cycle, right before a huge rally in the bonds about to begin. A lot of people are saying that this is the end of the bond bull market. It already happened several times during this continuous 40-year-old bond bull market, which I think is only beginning. I think the real rally in the bonds is actually ahead of us. The last 40 years were just a taste. And because of a convexity, actually 30 years, when they rally from 3% yield to zero yield, could rally as much in price as they would rally from infinite yield to 3% yield. So convexity-driven rally could be really staggering going on forward from here. So that's the big picture. I also put zero weight on discussions like breaking 3.1% yield on 10-year notes. Honestly, I think it's sheer nonsense. I don't think interest rates instruments obey to any yield charts, because yield charts are meaningless to begin with, because they don't reflect actually anybody's P&L. Only total return charts matter for interest rate instruments and fully funded total return. And even those charts, I think, have limited use in U.S. interest rate markets, but that's a subject for separate discussion. Also, yields have negative predicting power, so the higher they go, the lower they're likely to end up eventually, because higher yields create tighter monetary conditions, which is easier policy. So the fact that rates sold off last year was only increased my conviction that rates are going lower eventually, because that created tighter monetary conditions. And as for the longer story, well, we see the story playing out in every developed market country. We have population growth declining. Gradually, Japanification is unavoidable. Government budget deficit is expanding. Government debt is expanding. Rates are unavoidably pulled to zero. And I think U.S. is possibly in the last spike of rates before we go into perpetual zero rate policy.
Let's tie the U.S. dollar into this because we've seen a very strong U.S. dollar in the last several months. A lot of people, though, would say, you know what? Of course you see that because the Fed was in a hiking cycle. And at the same time, they were also beginning to reduce the size of their balance sheet through quantitative tightening. Now we've heard an announcement that maybe they're done with their hiking cycle, at least for now, and maybe they're even going to reduce the rate of balance sheet roll-offs. Does that change the outlook for the dollar? Is there an argument that the dollar has peaked here and it's time to move lower, or how do you see it evolving from here?
Absolutely not. It would be intuitive to expect the dollar to get stronger at the end of the hiking cycle. That's not how dollar historically behaves. In fact, one of the first hint that I got that we reached the end of the business cycle was the big sell-off on the dollar that occurred in the winter of 2018, exactly a year ago. That actually is rather typical of the end of tightening cycles. Interestingly, dollar index bottomed out the previous times in September 99, a few months before the end of the hiking cycle of 99-2000 and not that long before the recession. And it's also dollar bottomed out in February 2008, right at the onslaught of the Great Recession. After that, early in the recession, even as the Fed is cutting rates, dollar typically rallies and rallies pretty sharply. So I would expect for the next 2 years, very strong tailwind for the dollar and dollar performing stronger. And I wouldn't expect to see serious weakness in dollar till we go to zero rates and new round of quantitative easing.
Alex, you just mentioned quantitative easing, but before we go there, the official story is still quantitative tightening. So let's talk about the dynamics of how quantitative tightening affects markets. But why don't we start with how much quantitative tightening do you think is left before, as you say, they reverse policy completely toward another round of easing?
My best guess is probably 2 or 3 months more, but the range of possibilities is very wide. I do think they're reluctant to stop quantitative tightening, and the evidence has to be very strong for them to change policy, which is very bullish for bonds because it makes me sure that Fed will not get ahead of the curve, which means the financial conditions will remain tight into the beginning of this recession. With regards to quantitative tightening, I believe quantitative tightening is kind of a counterpart of fiscal expansion because it's essentially increasing the supply of U.S. treasuries out there that someone has to buy. And there is two possibilities. Either foreign buyers have to buy the incremental supply of treasuries, which drives capital account surplus and drives dollar up because foreign buyers have to buy dollars to buy U.S. treasuries. It doesn't matter at what price they're buying them. Eventually, someone has to buy them. So on a given day, we would have all sorts of price durations of treasuries, but they have to clear somewhere. So alternatively, and I think we've seen more of that, that domestic buyers have to buy U.S. treasuries, but that just displaces other investment. They have to take money out of other things and to put them into treasuries. A third possibility that would deny this story is that if the incremental buyers of treasuries were institutions like banks, who can use them essentially like cash as collateral. Now, in this case, I'm going to give you my conjecture that banks are tapped out and are not strong incremental buyers of treasuries. They've had as much of them as they could over the last few years. But I think due to various balance sheet restrictions and regulations, they can't really have too many of them. So the incremental treasuries will go either to domestic buyers displacing other investments and slowing down economy or to foreign buyers driving dollar up.
Alex, you mentioned driving the dollar up. Something I've noticed in recent weeks or months has been the commodity currencies like the Canadian dollar and Australian dollar have been awfully volatile. What's going on there and how does the commodity currency complex fit into this whole macro story?
Well, Australia appears to have its own idiosyncratic story developing, just as it has been in very much idiosyncratic over the last few decades and avoided recessions. It developed a housing market, which some people consider to be a bigger bubble and a bigger mortgage bubble than U.S. had in 2008, both in terms of kind of debt to income household ratio and even in terms of actual quality of mortgages. I cannot confirm it firsthand, but secondhand reading research, there are opinions that the quality of mortgage market in Australia is worse than was in the U.S. in 2007, and the unwind could be even more brutal on a country scale than the unwind in 2008 was in the US. So Australia could be heading for a very, very deep recession. And it seems to be at this denial stage that US was in 07 when we started to have subprime mortgage problems, but people were saying, well, there's clearly a problem with the mortgage markets, but that's not a problem with the economy. And 07, when the Fed eased a bit, stock market even actually reached new highs in October 07. And that was already after the major freeze of financial markets and major problems in the mortgage market. And somehow for a few more months until the Bear Stearns went down, things seem to be kind of okay. And I think we're in the stage, both in the US in terms of broader markets, but definitely in Australia, people already absorbing the scare of housing market correction there. But I don't think they yet realize how much damage it will do to the real economy there. That would be, again, my most likely conjecture. So I think a similar situation may be developing in Canada, because Canada debt-to-income ratios are also pretty severe and also higher than in the US in 08. And they also may have a housing problem. I'm not really an expert enough to yet say that it's going to happen. In Australia, it just happens to be more observable already. So I think that's what driving those currencies, all, especially Australia, not just the falling commodity prices per se, but the idiosyncratic housing market unwind.
So just as housing was supposedly contained to subprime, Australia's problems are contained to the extent of their exports to China, which is like half of their GDP. So let's talk about China and bring them into this, because I'm assuming you would agree with me that all of Australia's woes are really a reflection of China's woes. What's the story going on in China? Where is it headed? And how is it going to affect other countries like Australia and others around the world?
Well, China is always a very difficult country to make strong predictions about, because even though I may have strong views, but the timeline they operate on are very different from the usual business cycles that we're used to in the developed world. And because of their ability to, without any red tape, basically implement whatever stimulus measures they want, the ability to manipulate the situation and postpone any financial problems or gloss over them is very vast. On the other hand, historically, the math of what's going on in China is not working out. They have a huge amount of private debt, probably not precedented in history. And again, I'm not the person to do the first deep bottom-up research on what it is, but we're talking about like tens of trillions of dollars, more than US, more than anything, both in terms of absolute numbers and the relation in relation to GDP. It's also huge numbers. And typically such debt can only be sustained by very rapid growth, because when you have a very rapid growth, even if your businesses are not profitable, the cash flows generated by new growth can assure debt service. So it's kind of like a Ponzi scheme cash flow situation. I think that game is over for China. Honestly, I thought it would unwind 3 or 4 years ago. But 3 or 4 years ago, we had a very different picture. And that's why any calls for global recession 3 or 4 years ago were ex ante incorrect, because we had a positive momentum on interest rates. So interest rates have fallen globally very significantly by 2015, 2016. And that provided a relief for any kind of debt problems around the world. We don't have the situation today because the rates in the US have risen. The rates in other countries have stayed at least stable, but not fallen. And I believe that China cannot service the debt within its economy. And usually some sort of catastrophic unwind should occur. As the history is with communist country, typically this unwind is kind of happens in the background, but then is much more abrupt and terrifying than it does, than it's in the market economy.
When we had things fall apart in the United States in 2008 and 2009, it was largely because nobody fully understood just how much was being securitized and how some of these very exotic mortgage products worked. And that led to an over-leveraging and a misunderstanding of risk. In point, people have pointed out when they look at something like Canada and China's housing markets, well, you don't really have that kind of risk. It seems to me like China is the place where you do have it. So if China were to really fall apart, if we had a unwind of the unsustainable debt. The excess debt in China builds up just as the excess unserviceable subprime debt in the United States built up, to the point of bringing on a crisis. Is there a transmission risk? You said it was not justified several years ago when it was a popular narrative. What about now? Is there transmission risk that China blows up and takes the rest of the world with it?
Yes, I think there is definitely not a risk, but actually a very high probability of a shockwave from China. What we cannot estimate right now, how bad it is going to be for the rest of the world. My guess is, as you alluded to earlier, countries like Australia will be hit harder than countries like Mexico. But who knows? It's very hard to predict where the cracks. Basically, when such a shockwave comes, think about this as an earthquake, right? Then wherever there is a crack, that building will fall. And it's hard for us to know which buildings have cracks until we shake them very hard. But I think China could be that earthquake, because in the past, for example, in 98, we had a Russian debt default, which proved to be an earthquake that brought down long-term capital management and shook the whole financial system. Even though the size of this Russian debt default, it's really like laughably small relative to what China is dealing with right now. So, yes, I think China is likely to have a crisis. And yes, I think it will likely to shake up the world. But it's very hard for me to estimate what exact impact.
Let's move over to Japan then, because certainly Japan, if we're talking about earthquake zones, is a place that's been talked about for a long time in terms of the excessive debt they have. But somehow they seem to continue to muddle through. What do you see on the horizon for Japan?
Well, Japan kind of wrote the playbook. I believe that all developed market economies are now going by Japan's playbook. One of the misconceptions I think people have is that fiscal deficit and fiscal expansion automatically leads to higher interest rates or even weaker currency. And we can see how in Japan it led to exactly the opposite. It led to fairly strong domestic currency, so strong that they continuously complain of its being too strong. And it led to perpetual zero to negative interest rates. And in that environment, you actually can sustain very big debt. If you are a productive economy with a good manufacturing base like Japan and some good current account, you can actually have almost infinite amount of debt and just sustain it with zero rates. When it becomes unsustainable, if like emerging market countries who have to borrow in foreign currency, then eventually that thing collapses and they all end up with sooner or later with a balance of payments crisis. But I don't think Japan has any risk of balance of payments problems. So as long as you have strong domestic currency, you can pretty much sustain any amount of debt because the valve comes through the currency. Until your currency collapses, you have infinite tool to deal with your debt because you can keep monetizing it. And that's how Japan is able to muddle through.
If that principle holds true, then would that suggest that the rest of the developed world, Europe and the United States, has much longer to get away with everything than everybody thinks? Because, you know, certainly Japan surprised everyone. There were people talking about the collapse of JGBs and the collapse of the currency 25 years ago. And, you know, it was a very good argument, frankly, at the time, but it hasn't happened yet. So does that mean it's 25 or 30 years before all of the largesse of central banks catches up with the Western world? Or is there something that brings it to a head sooner than that?
Well, it's very hard to look 25 years forward because even like technological disruptions 25 years forward could really change the face of the world. That makes me difficult to make predictions that long. But yes, I do think that U.S., as long as U.S. does not succeed in undermining the dollar, which would be like shooting yourself in the foot, I think as long as U.S. maintains the dollar strength, and I think it's very hard for them to undermine it because they could only talk it down, but all the policies actually leading to stronger dollar. They could sustain a lot of deficit and just take rates to zero like Japan and just muddle through it. Now, this is not an environment that makes everybody happy. I mean, Japan, while Japan wrote the playbook, I don't think many people are happy with that playbook. It's kind of a very mediocre playbook because you don't get great growth in this environment. And it also associated with negative population growth where this is where the developed world is heading anyway, and probably U.S. will be there fairly soon too. So it's not really a super happy scenario, but it's a very stable scenario.
Let's go around the world to Europe and talk about the situation there. Seems like things are just escalating and there's more and more tension in Europe and more people are starting to talk seriously about the European Union's days maybe being numbered. What do you see in Europe's future and what would the economic consequences and knock-on effects be?
Well, the breakup of EU, honestly, it's almost harder for me to visualize than China collapse, because that's a very strong institution. And I think importance of EU is underappreciated in terms of even maintaining global geopolitical stability. One of the things that EU has accomplished is that France is no longer fighting wars with Germany as they were doing like for hundreds of years before. So once you put all the countries in EU, create this economic union, you make them all beholden to each other economically, and that creates, and it's a big source of geopolitical stability. So the risks to EU breaking up, probably as much geopolitical as economic. And it is hard to predict what's going to happen to the currency, because you don't even know what to do with the currency once they break up. Paradoxically, if you default to Deutschmark, the currency actually could end up being higher, because natural level of currency for Germany is probably higher than here, because Germany is running a huge current account surplus at this level of euro, while for the rest of Europe, about 115, 120 seems about right. And our brief venture to 125 a year ago seemed to have brought on recession in Europe. So there are a lot of tensions there. I think they'll be reluctant to actually break up. And I think the example of Brexit is not encouraging other exits.
One of the theories that some people have brought up is to say that Europe is a proxy for the rest of the developed world. If you look at where European stock markets have clearly rolled over before the U.S. did, European economic conditions are deteriorating. And, of course, we also have the escalation of unrest with the Yellow Jackets movement and so forth. So, Alex, is there any basis to this notion that Europe is maybe leading everyone else lower?
Honestly, I'm not sure of that. As a general rule, I'm not sure. As of recent years, quite possibly, because I've seen a pattern in Europe that has developed last few years in Europe with very much predicted, I think, what was happening in US. I think about a year ago, European economic numbers looked very strong. And there was a lot of talk about Europe even potentially not just exiting quantitative easing, but potentially even raising rates. And there was this optimism about inflation rising in Europe. But if you look back at Europe, where it was a couple of years prior to that, in the end of, say, 2016, we could see euro being at 105, which for Europe as an export economy, very important, right? So we had very weak euro. We also had strong stock markets for a few years up to 2016, whatever, Brexit shook things up a little bit, but overall, right? We had also dramatic fall in interest rates all the way into Brexit. And with those financial conditions, inputs, creating incentive for economic growth, it was not surprising 2 years later, at the beginning of 2018, to see strong economic numbers. But by that time, while the economic numbers as a lagging indicators looked strong, the concurrent financial conditions have been deteriorating. As you've mentioned, stock markets already have rolled over. Euro got stronger. Interest rates, though they didn't go higher, but they stopped falling. And so unsurprisingly, a year from now, we're seeing a lot of weakness in Europe. And that creates a playbook for US. Because even a year ago, we started to see weakness in stock market, but financial conditions in the US have not been tightening significantly yet, because we had weaker dollar. We had a rise of interest rates and a shakiness of stock market, but weaker dollar, which somewhat compensated it. And stock market proceeded to still make new highs in 2018. But then we had a second bout of stock market volatility in US last fall. And that was already accompanied with meaningfully higher short-term interest rates. And the dollar this time was stronger. So now we're getting a negative impulse from financial conditions, which I think gives us a hint how US will follow in the footsteps of Europe to start producing weak economic numbers into the middle of 2019.
With all of these issues around the world that seem like a potential cause for future concern, let's talk about precious metals, gold and other precious metals. What's your outlook there?
So gold is a hot subject, and a lot of people think that really like being in gold, and I'm actually one of those people. I do like gold, but with the following caveat. I would not play gold for the next 10% run up or down. I don't actually care whether gold is 1200 or 1400. In fact, given where we are in the cycle, I don't necessarily expect very strong performance from gold because, as I've mentioned, I actually expect dollar to be strong in the next 2 years. And just because of the tautological correlation, when dollar is stronger, typically it's harder for gold to rally a lot, though it can still rally, but it could be the best performing currency. But if you measure it in dollar terms, in terms of another really good, well-performing currency, it's harder to perform. However, when you look through the cycle, when you say, well, we don't know when this, maybe they'll even hike this year, or maybe they'll ease this year. Sooner or later, we'll have a recession. That's, everyone agrees with it. Sooner or later, we will get, rates will probably go far down from here, even if they have to go a little bit up again first. But once the rates go close to zero, once we have a new bout of expansionary policy, whether it is quantitative easing or not, at the end of it, gold will probably triple from here. So I would look for gold 3,000 or 4,000. It will be consistent with what happened at the end of previous recessions. So looking 4 or 5 years forward, the outlook for gold is so positive that I would want to have some now, lest I actually miss that move.
But it sounds like you do leave plenty of room for a little move down before the big move up.
Yeah, it just doesn't affect my strategy. But yes, I could easily see like 10% move down would not have any impact on my strategy at the moment.
Alex, I'm curious if you have a view on the changing correlation patterns that we've seen with gold. For a while there, gold and the Japanese yen just seemed to, you know, be almost pegged to each other. And then suddenly it wasn't the Japanese yen, it was the Chinese yuan. And on October 11th, that ended, and it seems to be that it's on its own new trajectory. Something I notice since October 11th is that we're not really seeing the same inverse relationship that normally exists with the dollar index. We're seeing gold outperform not only on days that the dollar is down, but also on days that the dollar is up. Makes me start to think, because I have a very similar view to yours, that I think gold probably makes a push down before we eventually see a really big move up. Makes me wonder if maybe it's happening and I'm late to the party. Do you think that these changes in correlation have any meaning, and do you have any insight as to what might be causing them?
Honestly, I would have a hard time reading into each of those correlation switches. But one thing to think about is gold is a measure of liquidity. Like when there is more cash, more of it can go into gold. So when we had, for a while, we actually had relatively hawkish shift to policies around the world. And now we're beginning to get more dovish. So it's not surprising that to me right now that gold would perform in terms of euro, in terms of yen, because they're pretty dovish and they're sticking now to negative interest rates. One interesting thing I observe about gold, for example, in euro terms, is that it actually has positive real carry, despite the storage costs. But when you factor in very deep negative nominal interest rates and very deeply negative real interest rates in Europe, gold actually has positive real carry. And I think that is beginning to catch up to the situation. When there was a speculation that Eurozone might raise rates, maybe that was offsetting it. But when that speculation has gone away, like the nonsense it was to begin with, now I see a beat to gold in terms of euro, and probably the same applies to yen. And China, that's a hard subject. Well, first of all, there could be big operators in gold to begin with, right, in terms of managing their reserves. But also, it's just kind of its own animal. It's very hard for me to read into it from the top of my head.
Alex, we touched earlier on the changing direction of interest rates. I want to come back to that because you wrote a book back in 2015 called The Next Perfect Trade. And a very central theme in that book was the predictive value of interest rate trends on equity prices. So tell us a little bit more about both what the book predicted, but also how that's starting to play out in the marketplace.
Okay, so when I was writing this book in 2014, I was observing historical trends in the bond markets. One of the things that I noticed is the secular uptrend in the treasury bonds when you take into account total return on bond futures, for example. And I've also predicted that it would be a highly superior trade to be long bonds for the subsequent several years. The interesting way that over this, so the book, I wrote it in 2014. It came out in 2015. So we have almost 4 to 5 years of data since then. We had a lot of headwinds to the bond market since, from very robust employment market to elections in the U.S. that could be viewed as negative for U.S. Treasury bonds, to all sorts of other things, like even simple absence of huge catastrophes is negative for bonds, because any catastrophe in the world could have given them extra bid. So still the bonds performed well. A U.S. Treasury bond delivered positive return since 2014, despite every possible thing being wrong. And that's a characteristic of a superior trade, what I talk a lot in my book. One of the interesting observations I made also in my book is, since a lot of people try to predict performance of stock market, and I cannot claim that I have a perfect prediction, but what I found is a very good indicator is interest rate momentum. If you look today and ask yourself a very simple question, are interest rates today higher or lower than they were 2 years ago? That will give you a very good answer on how likely stock market will be higher or lower 2 years from now. So again, to repeat, looking back 2 years on bonds will help you to look forward 2 years on stocks. So when I drew this chart, I saw a pretty good fit, but I didn't have the data over the last few years. And when we extend this chart that I drew in the book, the fit was actually pretty amazing. If you go back to 2016, you could have been concerned about stock market because there were severe corrections, but the interest rates in 2016 were significantly lower than they were prior, say in 2014. And that, according to my observation, essentially precluded stock market from underperforming in the subsequent 2 years. The interest rate momentum has not changed to negative till probably late 2016 after the election in the U.S. And guess when the stock momentum seriously changed? It seriously changed exactly 2 years from then, from that moment, which is the end of 2018. And we're still right now, we're still living in the world of kind of flat to negative interest rate momentum. And that allows us, because even though long-term rates may be the same, similar to where they were 2 years ago, but the short-term rates have risen significantly. And in this world, that does not by itself guarantee weak stock market, but it opens the door for weak stock market. That's why I think incrementally the chances of weaker equity market in the future is more likely. And I think those who want to read those chapters on my book on historical pattern, and the last few chapters in which I discuss in detail the regime changes, which include the regime changes that occurred in the year 2000, which I describe back then several years ago, but reading that piece right now feels kind of uncanny how similar it is to what's been happening last year.
Now, Alex, you manage a hedge fund which is only available to accredited investors, and your compliance department has asked us not to share with our listeners some of the investor communications that we received from you that helped me prepare for this interview. So unfortunately, we can't send those out for compliance reasons, but you do write a blog. Tell us a little bit about the blog, what is contained in it, and where people can access it.
So my blog can be found very easily using my name, Alex Gurevich, at tumblr.com. It could also be accessed through my Twitter account, which is my A, like my first initial, agurevich23. And it's a verified Twitter account, so you could go from there to my blog directly. I post there various market pieces which are not necessarily super time sensitive. Sometimes there could be excerpts of my investor letters, something just makes it to the general public a few weeks after it makes it to investors. And it's more of a general thoughts about markets or ideas about what's going on, something which I don't view as proprietary. Any investors who want to learn more, or any accredited investors who want to learn about us, could just go to our website, www.honteinv.com. So Honte, like the name of the firm, INV, like investment.com.
Well, Alex, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Alex back onto the show. The first question you hit him with was just, where are we in the business cycle? In my mind, he's right on cue with what we were talking about, which is that the business cycle has already turned. What did you take away from the interview?
Patrick, for me, this entire interview was a series of confirmations, and I put a lot of weight on confirmations of my views from Alex because I know he's a guy who does not fall victim to that trap of, you know, saying the same thing everybody else is saying because it's the same thing to say. You know that you can count on Alex. If he's got a different view that's out of consensus, he's going to express it without hesitation. And the fact that a guy who's as smart as Alex, who I haven't talked to in more than a year, is right on the same page as I am. It's definitely, you know, business cycle is ending. We're late cycle. The market has topped, and we're probably headed toward lower treasury yields, at least initially, until we get through this downturn. It all tends to jibe with the views that we've had, and to me, it's really just excellent confirmation to get it from a guy like Alex.
You know, I've always been in that same camp that interest rates are going to gravitate towards zero again, and that when the central banks turn, that treasury bonds will once again be a great performing asset. And what's really interesting is Alex really has that strong conviction, and I have to share it. I mean, I think overall, there is only one direction for interest rates, especially if the business cycle's turned, that for interest rates once again to turn once the economy starts to weaken. On that note, Eric, I just wanted to thank you for coming on to the Market Huddle as a guest. It was great to have you on the show. Those of you that missed Eric's interview on the Market Huddle, the link is in the Research Roundup email.
And Patrick, I know that you are late for an airline flight, so we're going to have to make it an abbreviated postgame segment this week. But we'll be back to our regular format next week, folks. And in the meantime, we sure need your help. So please continue to let other podcasts know that I would love to be interviewed on more podcasts. It'll help us get more listeners on this one. And of course, we encourage you to register your free account at macrovoices.com. Won't cost you anything. You're not going to get spammed. And what you will get is our free research roundup email, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It's just a compendium of links to all of the best content that we could find on the internet each week. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find that transcript for today's interview with Alex, as well as the link to Alex's Tumblr blog. There's also an interesting article from Michael Lebowitz titled MMT Sounds Great in Theory, But... As well, there's an interesting article from CNBC about the Bank of England seeing the weakest outlook for the UK since 2009. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account, @MacroVoices, for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter, @EricSTownsend, and myself, @PatrickCeresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.